Welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The Brothers Anderson are... This is Eric.
It is better to be truthful and good than to not.
This is Brother Jay.
You ask me if I have a God complex? Let me tell you something. I am God.
This is Drew.
There is a storm coming like nothing you have ever seen, and not a one of you is prepared for it.
And they are sometimes joined by guests like...
This is Travis.
I had to stop her from screaming.
And Diane.
If you men only knew.
So sit back, close your eyes, and let us take you away. Unless you're driving, in which case keep your eyes open and watch the road and, you know, anyway. Welcome, this is Eric.
This is Brother Jay.
And tonight we're going to talk about the 1982 movie Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan. Probably my favorite of the Star Trek movies.
Yeah, I don't know where I think after I have rewatched all of them, I'll have to go back and re-rank them. I'm not sure yet. I'm gonna withhold judgment.
Well, okay, I should withhold judgment as well, but certainly an
upgrade. In your remembrance, you recall this as your favorite.
Oh yeah, because it had all the action that was missing out of the first one. Because the first one was Star Trek, the slow motion picture. I imagine we both saw this in the theater.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we saw it together.
Yeah, I can't imagine not.
Yeah, and I was out of my element when I watched this, because I watched this Saturday night in my hotel room after driving all day to be with our other brother, Drew, and his lovely family. I felt myself pretty tired, so I went back to the hotel room. And then, of course, once I sat down, I'm like, oh, now I'm wide awake now. So I went ahead and watched the movie, but like my notes are scribbled on hotel stationery. So all kinds of crazy, because I had to number the pages. So it'll be an interesting trip tonight. So.
Oh, well, that's the best. I love hotel stationery. I miss hotel stationery. I mean, it wouldn't be worth traveling all the time, but still.
Yeah, well,
because I don't miss hotel rooms.
Yeah, this is all kinds of just nondescript white stationery, except at the bottom, stamped dialing instructions inside. Inside of what? I'm not sure, because I just have this pad of paper and there are no instructions here, but inexplicably. But at any rate.
Oh, that's funny. Someone took the time to print dialing instructions inside in just a pad of paper.
Yeah, I'm sure there was like a pad folio somewhere in the room, but I couldn't be bothered to find it. Huh. Also, don't need instructions to use a phone.
Well, you never know. Yeah. The number of calls I get mistakenly from hotel rooms is amazing.
In your job?
Yes, of course. The number of mistaken calls I get from anybody who has to dial 9 to get out is also amazing.
Really? You would think somebody would not be dialing 9911.
No, all you have to do is dial 911.
Oh, like, and it goes right to the switchboard?
If that second one it takes, it'll automatically be transferred.
Oh, even if it's through a PBX?
Yep.
Oh, I didn't see it. These are things that the layman doesn't know. Yeah. Well, that makes sense, though, then.
Yeah, well, yeah. Otherwise, 9911, it wouldn't work at all. But the problem is, when someone just dials that extra one too many times, it's not a good thing.
Right.
Anywho, so shall we just dive into the movie?
Yeah.
Okay. This movie, and a lot of my talking about this movie, there's going to be some nostalgia, but I'm also going to be comparing it heavily to the movie before it.
Of course you are.
Because this is the answer to that movie.
I have some predictions too, so.
Well, that's okay. The first movie cost $43 million to make and made money back, but not the kind of money they wanted. So they decided to regroup and 3 years later came out with this movie. And the budget on this was somewhere between $11 and $13 million.
So a quarter of the first movie.
Yeah, and as it turns out, it didn't make a ton of money.
the movie?
Yeah, it made enough, but I don't think it made as much as, say, it should have. It was nowhere near any of the Star Wars money.
Well, are you talking in general or opening weekend?
I'm talking about worldwide box office.
It made $80 million.
Yeah, which is great on an investment of 13 or 11 or whatever, but it's not great when you consider that how much did the first one make?
Well,
like 130 or 180 or something?
Well, but you're talking, it's a different time.
Well, it's true, but still. Anyway.
And I think enough people were turned off by the first movie that they didn't want, that, you know, they didn't go back to the second movie.
Well, that's the thing. If you were not a Star Trek fan, you probably weren't going to be headed to this movie. Although this movie hopefully made some new Star Trek fans.
Undoubtedly it did.
Yeah, because this is a quality movie. It's no more and no less than a popcorn movie, a fun summer movie. I mean, it has kind of a sting at the end, but for the most part, this is a fun movie, and it's pretty much just like a 2 hour long episode of the series.
Kind of, with better effects and it was a little more, it had some dramatic flair to it.
Oh yeah, no, there was some good stuff in there. And one more thing before we dive into the plot that kind of explains how the movie starts. In a convention in the UK, like a year before, one of the producers slipped that Spock died in the movie. And people were not happy about that revelation.
I remember that.
Yeah, people were like, oh, you can't do this. This is horrible. So that's why in the opening scene of this movie, Spock dies. So and
in the opening scene?
Yeah, we'll get to it. Yeah, that was directly because of that issue. It was probably in there to begin with, but this way it was very clear that Spock dies during the Kobayashi Maru.
Oh, I never got that.
Yeah, see, if you're expecting Spock to die, what better than him dying in the first 2 minutes of the movie?
Or I see.
First 5 minutes of the movie.
So that was kind of a directorial misdirection so that people didn't spend the whole movie thinking, oh, Spock's going to die. They're like, oh, I get it.
Yeah, so they'll say, oh, that was a lame trick, and then forget all about it. And then later, when it really happens, spoiler.
Oh, man.
Okay, so the plot. The movie opens without that minute of black screen nonsense 2001 crap from the first movie. And it opens...
Well, kind of, but not really.
It opens with the old theme.
But it has a really long intro.
It does, and the whole title sequence is pretty boring, but it's simple and it's fine. Just not.
And it has it still has a 2001 opening. It has the long title opening with the cinematics. So
yeah, but it doesn't give you the black screen, like everybody sitting down to the opera or whatever crap.
Yeah.
So it starts off. It doesn't have a cold open. It just starts off with the title sequence.
Right.
But then it opens, after the title sequence, it opens to the bridge of the Enterprise, presumably. And the bridge is all our favorite crew members, except instead of Kirk in the captain's chair, we have Captain Rebecca from Cheers.
She wasn't Rebecca from Cheers yet.
Oh, I know. This is pre-Rebecca. That's Lieutenant Savick, played by a fetching Kirstie Alley.
Yeah, who is replaced in the next movie.
Yes. So they're on the bridge, and they pick up a signal from the fuel carrier Kobayashi Maru in the neutral zone. So they go on a rescue mission, but as soon as they enter the neutral zone... This is a Federation starship going into the neutral zone, breaking all sorts of treaties. The Klingons attack. And as the Klingons attack, one by one, the crew on the bridge are killed, except for Savick. So it turns out this is all an exercise. It's a scenario that they give in Starfleet Academy, and it's called the Kobayashi Maru. And it's designed to test the character of Starfleet officers. It is a no-win scenario.
Which is where we get the line where Kirk it comes back to kind of give the summary of everything that's gone on. in the training simulation, and he says to, and I actually wrote this down then, because I said, he'd come up to Spock and said, "Aren't you dead?" And I wrote down, "Ooh, ouch, too soon."
Yeah. This movie opens with banter. We have banter and cordiality between the crew members. There was a little bit of that during the first movie, but not a lot. This movie is full of it.
Yeah, they're very familiar with one another.
And it makes it fun.
Yeah, the camaraderie is nearly palpable.
Yeah, and there's still an issue with the fact that Kirk is an admiral, and now Spock is a captain, but this is a group of just trainees that are aboard.
And so I wrote down too, I'm like, okay, he's an admiral again. Like, didn't he learn the first two times?
Well, even Spock tells him that maybe it wasn't a good idea to accept that promotion.
Like why are you, like, stupid? Like, why do you just keep doing this? Like, this is so dumb. Anyway.
Yeah, well, it happens to be Kirk's birthday, too. And I looked this up because I was trying to figure out how old Kirk was. How old do you think Kirk is? Because he feels old.
Chronologically?
How old is
in the
character of James T. Kirk at this time in this movie? How old was he?
40?
Nope. 52.
Okay.
Which 40 would be bad enough. Because, I don't know, both of us are over 40. But 52 is right around the corner. Kinda.
Yeah.
And I can see it. I mean, you know, you start feeling old, and, you know, I'll be wearing the reading glasses any minute now. So, yeah, so it's Kirk's birthday. The one note I had was that the uniforms are 1,000 times better.
They're so much better. They're actually, I think they're actually pretty stylish, even considering what the time it was in 1984, right?
I would wear the officer uniform today.
Yeah, no, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, well, it's sort of a military uniform, which is something that Gene Roddenberry was against.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't want to have military be part of this whole thing. But, you know,
Well, I think naming it Starfleet, that ship had sailed, no pun intended.
Well, that's the thing. This is a very nautical show. In fact, later in this movie, this becomes a submarine movie.
Well, and also, it becomes, you know, Moby Dick. It becomes, you know, it's got a lot of, you know, ocean and sea vessels. I mean, because, you know.
Oh, no. Everything Khan again, says, every big, like, big speech that Khan gives. Yeah, is directly from Moby Dick.
Yeah.
And Kirk is talking about, it opens and closes with Tale of Two Cities, but the whole movie is kind of if you can compare it to Paradise Lost. So it's got lots of literary things going on. But anyway, Captain Kirk is in the dumps, because he's an admiral. I'm sorry, Admiral Kirk is in the dumps. His birthday. So, Bones gives him the Romulan ale and tells him to get his command back before he really gets old.
Yeah, and he has to part with any of his 80s furniture that's present on screen.
Oh, yeah. He collects antiques. And Spock actually gives him the Tale of Two Cities. And they have a nice little rapport. And then we skip to the Federation Starship Reliant, where we have Captain Clark Terrell, played by Paul Winfield, and First Officer is Commander Pavel Chekov. And they are at SETI Alpha 6 on a mission to search for a lifeless planet so they can test this device called the Genesis device. It's a technology designed to reorganize matter to create habitable worlds for colonization. It's kind of what we would call terraforming now.
Very much so.
Yeah, so they have to find a planet that is just basically barren of life. And they find one that's in SETI Alpha 6 that looks like it's a good candidate, but there's a little bit of reading of life. So they're going to go down to investigate. And again, and this is a trope of Star Trek, and it's hard to get around. as a device, but you end up with the commander and captain going down to the surface, like leaving your ship in other hands. It's like you'd think there'd be a SWAT team they could just send down.
Well, in Star Trek, the Next Generation, you know, there's a big point of that where Commander Riker repeatedly prevents Picard from beaming down. He's like, you know, your place is on the ship.
Yeah, so this tension, too. But in this case, Chekhov and Terrell beam down to the surface. By the way, on board the Reliant is a doctor, Carol Marcus, and her son, David Marcus, who's also a doctor. Now,
well, no, they're not on the Reliant. They're on Starbase Regular 1.
Okay, so they were never on the Reliant? They were just, no. Oh, they were just talking by
Hyper Channel is what they called it.
Okay, sorry, my mistake.
They were discussing the protocols of, you know, what was, if it was preeminent matter, it had to be, you know, they had to be sure there was no doubt that there was nothing on the planet, otherwise their research was all void. And so that was the whole point of why Chekhov and the captain had to beam down to make sure there truly was nothing down there. And the captain, of course, reportedly was going to be the one to make the executive decision that if there was something, they were going to beam it somewhere else.
Well, I was going to ask.
It seems like it would be a violation of the Prime Directive, but...
Well, also, why couldn't they just take the phaser to whatever it was, the plankton that was down there, and call it good?
No, I can't do that.
Well, of course.
Destroy something.
Of course you can't.
No, but the point is made that, yeah, like, how do you know he wasn't going to do that?
Yeah, so...
Nope, nothing here, sorry.
So, Chekhov and Terrell... Is it Terrell? It must be Terrell.
Terrell, Captain okay. Terrell.
Sorry. So, Chekhov and Terrell beam down to the surface. I don't know where that voice came from. I apologize. I'll go back to my normal, hi-ho, Eric D. Podcaster here. So, anyway, they're communicating with Doctors Carol and David Marcus, mother and son, and we'll talk about them a little bit later. But on the surface of SETI Alpha 6, they discover a cargo container, and they go inside, and they see the insignia of the USS Botany Bay. Now, Chekhov remembers the Botany Bay, and he wants to get the fuck out of Dodge.
Yeah, no, he has what I would say is probably the best thing is to a visceral response that one could have.
Oh, yeah.
He probably crapped his spacesuit.
Absolutely.
Botany Bay. Botany Bay. Oh, no. We've got to get out of here now. Damn.
What
hurry.
About, what about the
never
cardboard?
Mind it. Hurry. Hurry.
Chekhov, what's the matter with you? Chekhov.
Come on.
Where
hurry.
Were
but then they are captured by genetically engineered tyrant Khan Noonien Singh.
And the revelation is complete. But amazingly... They have some pretty fancy jewelry and outfits for being stranded on a planet.
Let me tell you, Ricardo Montalban is amazing. First of all, he was in the original series. This is actually a continuation of a story that started in the original series where they stranded
Khan. Yeah, it was an episode.
Yeah, I'm sorry, an episode, yeah. Where they stranded Khan on this island, or island. They stranded Khan on this planet. Well, they stranded him on SETI Alpha 5 that was comparatively an oasis, but things happen. Khan, his costume is as impressive as his hair.
Oh, yeah. No, pretty much everything about him I wrote later. I'm like, I wonder if that's really his chest. And then I wrote, no, it has to be prosthetic. But I don't know. I couldn't tell. I'm like, no, he's got to be too old in real life. It's got to be a fake chest.
You know what? There's a lot of discussion about this. This apparently is his real chest. He was a bodybuilder.
You know, I'm glad to hear that because it was amazing. Because otherwise, it was the best makeup job ever.
It's pretty great. The costumes in this are pretty great.
Yeah, there's some good theatrical costumes in here for sure.
Well, and when Khan talks, it's very dramatic, and it's great. And he's got that great 80s hair. And I was trying to figure out who the hell he reminded me of. And then it hit me. And then I had to go make a picture for you for the internet.
You did. I laughed out loud at work.
Yes, because I actually put a picture of Dorothy Zbornak and Khan Noonien Singh together. And I swear they could be brother and sister.
Yeah.
Yeah, I even asked Journey, my daughter, I said, hey, do they look like? She goes, same hair. Like, absolutely the same hair. Same hair, same eyebrows, yeah. Same nose. But anyway.
Ricardo Montalban really brought a lot of gravitas to his performance. I mean, he really sold the part. He really believed he would just reach out and strangle you to death.
Well, and he is, you know, he is Ahab. He is single-minded in his pursuit of Kirk.
Well, he believes himself invincible and infallible. I mean, he really, because I wrote down his quote.
It is only the fact of my genetically engineered intellect that allows us to survive.
Well, you know, during World War III, it was fought, you know, through, it was like the eugenics war. And they created these supermen. And Khan was one of the Übermensch. That's from Nietzsche, the Superman theory. But anyway, no, this is all about eugenics. And they dealt with all that during the episode. Khan, he is genetically superior to all other humans. Yet he has one flaw. Well, two flaws. One is arrogance. And the other is inexperience, which we'll deal with later.
Yeah, for being a guy who was in cryogenic, suspension for a while, you know, even though he has a superior intellect, his grasp of the technology didn't quite come up to speed.
No, although he did spend a lot of time reading.
He did.
So, and he read like all of the ship manuals in a hurry when he got aboard the Enterprise the first time. But he actually tells the story to Captain Terrell, because Terrell had never heard it, that the Enterprise discovered Khan's ship adrift 15 years earlier, and Khan was in suspended animation, but woke up and fought Kirk for command of the Enterprise. But Kirk quelled that and stranded him, marooned him, exiled him.
Because of what happened on the Enterprise, Kirk couldn't keep him on board because he was too much of a security threat. And so they opted, after a trial and finding him guilty, they said they found a planet, a quote-unquote Type M planet, that was suitable, a virtual paradise, where they were going to put them down and let them, you know, make their own world. And they gave them limited resources. I think they gave them, what would be the equivalent of a replicator and some supplies and some stuff so they could get started. And then, of course, his love interest from the ship went with him. So it took one of the the Enterprise crew, because she was in love with, they were in love. Khan and the woman were in love. So ostensibly, Kirk left them on there to have their own planet, which in retrospect was like, why wouldn't they just try and get space flight and with their superior intellect and then just come and, you know, blow people out of the sky?
Yeah, well, and that may have been coming, but unfortunately, they were on SETI Alpha 5. Unfortunately, SETI Alpha 6 exploded, and it shifted the orbit of SETI Alpha 5 and destroyed its ecosystem, and also caused the death of Khan's wife. So Khan blames Kirk and plans revenge. And in the most memorable, as far as I'm concerned, and the second most iconic scene in the movie, he implants Chekhov and Terrell with some indigenous eels.
I call them baby rhino scorpion brain diggers.
Oh, they're awesome. It's fantastically creepy. They did such a good job.
I wrote, this scene terrified me in the theater.
Oh, it's actually pretty terrifying. Still, because, you know, bugs and ears, and the ear doesn't look particularly good, you know, 30 years later as far as special effects. It looks kind of plasticky. But
didn't matter.
The bugs look great. And the noise, the sound design on this movie, the score is fantastic. It's, as far as I'm concerned, the score is just as good as the score for the first movie. And that was a great score. But the sound design, oh, the sound of these eels is so great.
Khan, listen to me.
These are pets, of course. Not white. Domesticated.
Khan, Captain Kirk was only doing his duty.
No.
And Chekhov is chewing the scenery of having bugs in his head.
No, it was terrible. It was terrible. Terrible, terrible, terrible. It was terrible. It's my nightmare right there.
Yeah, isn't that great?
The fact that they put them in their helmets and locked the helmets on. It's just like, oh,
it makes me it makes me feel better about wearing headphones to bed.
You don't even know where I worked or where they've had to pull things out of people's ears.
Oh, I can guess. I can guess.
Yeah, no, you can.
So that it enters the ear and wraps itself around part of their brain and makes them susceptible to mind control. And he uses them to capture the Reliant. So Khan learns about Genesis and attacks Regular One, where the device is being developed by Dr. Carol Marcus, B.B. Besh, and her son, Dr. David Marcus, Merritt Buttrick. Turns out that Carol and Kirk used to be lovers, and David is their son. Dun, dun, dun. By the way, if my notes are correct, both B.B. Besh and Merritt Buttrick died in 1993, unrelated.
Oh, dear, really?
Yeah, which is pretty sad, especially for Merritt Buttrick, who had been on Square Pegs, and he'd been on a bunch of stuff.
Square Pegs with Sarah Jessica Parker.
Yes, absolutely.
I remember Square Pegs.
He played like Slash or somebody like that.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I couldn't find out how he died, but it's, I mean, really young, actually.
He died in 1989.
Oh, 89. Yeah, okay, then they both died in 89.
Wow, that sucks.
Yeah, totally sucks.
Which is, you know, spoiler, he dies in the next movie anyway.
Well, still.
He worked up until his death. So.
Oh, yeah. No, he seemed to have been steadily, he was a steadily rising star, I think. But, what?
Do you know what he died from?
I don't. Please enlighten us.
He died of AIDS.
Oh, see, that's very sad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's too bad.
No,
That was noted on his death certificate. From complications from pneumonia from HIV. He'd been given a spinal tap to relieve cranial pressure on his brain.
See, that sucks.
Yeah, he does. After his untimely death, a photograph of him as Dr. David Marcus was featured in a scene from Star Trek VI.
Yeah, yep.
Sad. I didn't know he was dead. So
let's pour one out for our homie Merritt.
There's apparently a Star Trek movie supporting actor curse. I'll have to look at that for next week because we discussed.
I was gonna say, was Stephen Collins cursed to have to expose himself to a 13-year-old?
I don't know. So Persis Cambutta.
Yes, she died at 50.
B.B. Besh, Merritt Buttrick, Paul Winfield, Carl Steven. He played the younger Spock in Star Trek III. Teresa Victor. Who played the computer voice in 2 and 3. That's terrible. Wow. Just terrible. So apparently the supporting actors tend to drop dead from Star Trek. That's interesting.
Two words, red shirts. Although in this movie, all the commanders had red shirts. So, you know. Anyway, back to the Enterprise. They're just embarking on a 3-week training voyage where the Admiral is there to inspect the ship. And Spock is the captain. And most of the crew are trainees, but of course there are lots of senior officers on board, including all of our favorites, Scotty and Sulu and Uhura and Bones, of course. And aboard the crew is Scotty's nephew, Preston. Did you recognize Preston?
Escaped to Witch Mountain, right?
Yes, it's Ike Eisenman.
Yeah, but and so in the original end of the movie, though, it's never explained who he is. That's a deleted scene.
Yeah, that's the thing is that I only knew after the fact when I did the research that he's supposed to be Scotty's nephew because they don't mention it in the beginning.
There's a whole subplot and which doesn't so. Because it makes no sense why, so again, spoiler, later Scotty brings the body of him to the bridge. I'm like, why wouldn't you bring him to the sick bay?
Oh, yeah, well, Scotty is super distraught.
Yeah, well, he was in shock, but because, I mean, then, of course, the subplot was that it was his family and related. And B.B. Besh didn't die until 1996, by the way.
Get out of town.
She died in 96 at age 56.
So he died in 89?
Yeah.
Okay, then my notes are crap.
Yeah, she was on Northern Exposure, including roles in ER and Melrose Place.
She won an Emmy or was nominated for an Emmy for Northern Exposure as like a guest star.
Really?
Yeah.
Can I just say I hate that show?
Oh, I think it's kind of cute.
I just couldn't stand it. I just could not abide it.
Yeah, I was never a fan of Rob Morrow, but who is the girl with dry eyes? Short dark hair? The love interest pilot girl?
Are you talking about Janine Turner?
Yes.
The lead, right?
Yeah, she did the commercial because she's got chronic dry eye.
Okay. <that's>
Well, you know. Turn around, dry eyes.
That's.
At this point, we have a little bit of ship porn, but just enough to be to satisfy.
I wrote that down, by the way. I wrote more ship porn.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Then I also wrote, it looks like they Minecraft edited the Enterprise.
How so?
When the Enterprise is pulling out of the space dock, it's tiles. You can see the tiles and the different colors and the kind of the pixelation effect of the tiling. That's a very Minecraft thing. So.
Ah, okay. All right. Well.
And I also wrote down, oh, look, it's a tiny spacesuited guy. I think it may be the same spacesuited guy waving in space dock as in the first movie.
Actually, as it turns out, they recycled a bunch of scenes from the first movie. Just little things like when the shuttle docks. Yeah, that's all. Little clips from the first movie, and they use the first model, the same model as the first movie too, which is great. And why wouldn't you? These things are expensive. So we have Captain Spock and Lieutenant Savick, and Captain lets Lieutenant take her out of the
space dock.
The space dock, yeah. So Lieutenant Savick takes the whole thing out of space dock without scraping down the sides like Galaxy Quest. Still makes me laugh every time I see a scene like that.
Yeah.
When asking for a course setting, Captain Spock tells Sulu that he may indulge himself. Oh my.
I know, it sounds like a little bit of, it does sound kind of dirty.
It does, yes. So, but hey, Sulu gets a bigger role in this movie, so that's pretty great. Chekhov gives the creepy call to Regula One, and then, Dr. Marcus
gives the call to Kirk. He gives the roofie call to Regular One.
Oh, yeah.
Dr. Marcus, Compic coming in on Hyper Channel. It's the Starship Reliant.
On the screen, please, Jetta.
Come in, please. This is Reliant calling Regula One. Repeat, this is USS Reliant.
Commander, we are receiving. This is Regula One. Go ahead.
Ah, Dr. Marcus. Good. We're en route to you and should be there in 3 days.
En route? Why? We weren't expecting you for another 3 months. Has something happened?
Nothing has happened. CT Alpha 6 has checked out.
Then I don't understand why you're coming.
We have received new orders. Upon our arrival at Regula 1, all materials of Project Genesis will be transferred to this ship for immediate testing on CT Alpha 6.
Who in the hell do they think they are?
Please be quiet, Commander Chekhov. This is completely irregular.
I have my orders.
Put him down, Mother.
Who gave the order?
The order comes from Admiral James T. Kirk.
I knew it!
I knew it.
All along, the military is wanting to get down.
This is completely improper, Commander Chekov. I have no intention of allowing Reliant or any other unauthorized personnel access to our worker materials.
I'm sorry that you feel that way, Doctor. Admiral Kirk's orders are confirmed.
Please prepare to deliver Genesis to us upon our arrival. Reliant out.
Well done, Commander.
You realize, sir, they will attempt to contact Admiral Kirk and confirm the order.
So Carol Marcus calls Kirk pissed. Did you notice that Shatner was a better actor in this movie?
Marginally.
Well,
but yes.
Do you know why they got better takes from him? The director, whose name I didn't write down, I should have, definitely made a point. He found a trick that worked. He had Shatner do the scenes over and over and over and over until he was so tired that he just basically relinquished and gave to
anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
He tired him out so he could do nothing but be pliable.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's brilliant.
Isn't it?
But
so,
that's what you want a director to do.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And he mentioned that was the difference between a movie star and an actor. I think he was insinuating
a movie star.
Exactly. But and actually Shatner and certainly Kirk would appreciate this analogy. You know, like you take a young colt or a puppy and you just wear them out and then you get a lot better behavior out of them. Children,
yeah,
too, as
no,
a matter of fact.
Whatever works.
So they get this distress call, or a distressing call at least, from Regular One. So Kirk is going out there, and Spock is like, dude, you need to take command. That's fine. You're the most senior officer. It's only logical you take command. So Kirk, don't mind if you do. And en route there, they are ambushed by the Reliant. And this is a point where Savick, as the Reliant approaches without any communication, Savick tries to remind the Admiral of S.H.I.E.L.D. protocols, and Spock interrupts her and says the Admiral is well aware of Starfleet regulations. And then they get the shit blasted out of them.
Yeah.
So Savick is right. In fact, you get an idea. I don't know if you've worked with very many Lieutenant Savicks. I have. The ones that are pretty much have never been wrong. So the times that they are wrong, they are not very happy about it.
Yeah.
Like, she will not let the Kobayashi Maru go. She is bitter.
Yeah.
And nobody tells her how Kirk took it three times. And finally, he came up with the solution that, what does he say? Had the advantage of having not been tried yet.
Which is revealed later.
It's they make it a big part of the Star Trek reboot, too.
Yeah. And in some ways, by the way, it reminds me a little bit of Dad. That kind of storytelling. He has great humility about the events, but then the retelling of the story, there is no sheepishness or any kind of remorse.
Well, yeah.
I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I just it gave me a smile and a chuckle because I'm like, but for not some bad hair and some overacting, that could be our father.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, you know, our father doesn't like to lose either.
No.
Yeah. So if it's a game, you know, might as well play it to win, right?
And so during this whole interchange, by the way, with the Reliant and the Enterprise engaged in, you know, mortal combat up to this point. I wrote down, I finally noticed something. I said, with the exception of Joaquin, who is Judson Scott, who is uncredited in this movie.
I know. Why is he uncredited?
Well, yes. We'll get into that. But so he's the only crewman of Khan that talks. Nobody else has any lines. None of the other crew talk at all.
Well, maybe they weren't union?
I don't know. But I was like, it's almost, are they supposed to be brainwashed or was this a pay scale thing?
I don't know. It's very well could have been a pay scale thing because they do, at least on TV, if you don't have any lines, they pay you less. And if you have lines, they have to pay you more.
So the Judson Scott story.
Oh, do tell. Because I wrote it down. I'm like, why the hell isn't he credited? Like, actually, several people in this movie, by the way, played on the soap opera Santa Barbara.
Yeah, which is actually one of my favorites of all time. So.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was ridiculous. It was ridiculous.
It came on right after school, and it had a lot of young actors, and it was a sexy soap opera, so why not?
Well, it had Marcy Walker, so the guys loved her, and it had A. Martinez, and the chicks dug him.
Oh, forget Marcy Walker. It had Robin Wright.
Robin Wright, who was desperately trying every role to get off of it that she could.
Well,
which
still.
Which is why she landed The Princess Bride, which is another episode you should listen to if you haven't. So Judson Scott goes uncredited in the film, and I'm reading this off of a webpage. His agent believed he could get a bigger salary and a higher billing if he held out. He was proved mistaken, and the agent was summarily dismissed when basically, boom, no, he got nothing. I'm having a moment here. So Judson Scott guest starred in Next Generation alongside Merritt Buttrick.
Wow.
In an episode called Symbiosis. I didn't know that was him. I knew it was Judson Scott. I didn't know it was Merritt. I didn't recognize him. Wow.
Yeah, crazy. So what, did he want to be in the poster or something? Where did we run into this before? Sure. We ran into this before in a movie we've done.
Wasn't Sneakers, was it?
I don't think so.
God. Now it's in my head.
Oh, I know. And,
everybody was there. Rat Race.
Okay, yes. Yes, because it was Seth Green's friend.
Yeah.
The brother.
It was Rat Race where I have to look up his name.
Yeah, but he wanted to be on the poster.
Breckenmeyer, right?
No, it wasn't Breckenmeyer. It was the guy with the tongue stud, I'm pretty sure, because Breckenmeyer was on the poster.
Oh, Vince Valoof.
Yes, Vince Valoof. Ugh.
That was it, yeah. Sorry.
Wow. So sorry, Judson
everyone.
Scott.
We're down the rabbit hole.
No, it's okay. So Judson Scott was a proto Vince Valoof.
He was the original Vince Valoof.
Exactly. Yeah. Khan probably has a good saying about those who don't study history are doomed to repeat it. It's probably an old Vulcan saying. So yeah. So we have this fight between starships, which we didn't even see. I mean, you didn't see that level in any of the Star Trek up to date. I mean, when you saw any kind of battle, you just basically saw the people flying around the bridge and explosions, but you didn't actually see phasers hit ships and stuff.
Right. This was the very, it was the first battle porn you got.
Yeah. And by the way, there's a story that the director, he was sent the fifth script. And they didn't want to send it to him because it wasn't ready yet. And they're like, it's not very good. He goes, we'll just send it anyway. And they're like, well, it's not very good. So he read it. Turns out it wasn't very good.
The fifth?
The fifth, yes. So he said, well, what about the fourth script? And they're like, well, it's not quite like that. This isn't the fifth rewrite. This is the fifth entirely different script. Like, they sat down and wrote five different movies because the first four sucked. So the director is like, why don't we get together and read all of them? Because there's something in each of them that, you know, like the Lieutenant Savick character is great. And, you know, Kirk and his son are great. You know, let's just take the pieces from these different scripts and put them together and write it one cohesive script. And they're like, well, we have 7 days to do this. I says, what do you mean? Well, Industrial Light and Magic... Because this movie actually had a calendar date to be in the theaters before they even started filming.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So, like, Industrial Light and Magic needs, like, so many weeks, like 12 weeks. So, we need to have this buttoned down with the scenes they need in 7 days. So, the director goes, like, okay, cool. We'll just send everything to me, and I'll go up and spend a weekend and write the script. And sure enough, that's what happened.
Wow.
Yeah. So
that's pretty cool.
Yeah, for good or for bad. And in this case, I think it worked out rather well. I mean, people criticize this movie a little bit as being too much like an episode, but that's what you needed after the first movie.
Yeah.
You needed to start the ground, you know, hit the ground running. There's no more origin story. You just have to start in the middle in this one. But anyway, so we have the ship battle, and Khan hails the Enterprise and offers to spare Kirk's crew if they relinquish all the Genesis material. So Kirk is stalling for time and then uses a very sneaky prefix code to remotely lower the shields of the Reliant. And this is where Khan is forced to retreat and do repairs while the Enterprise limps to regular one. And this is where also where Ike dies in a very touching scene. He stayed at his post when the rest of the trainees ran. So, actually, give me just a minute to take a break here. Not in a Creepy Way, we'll be back after these messages. As always, we'd love feedback. Call us on our feedback hotline at 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. And we're back. So the Reliant with Khan and the Enterprise with Kirk have to kind of go their separate ways and do repairs. And there's a very touching scene.
They've each pretty much kicked the crap out of each other.
Yes. And Kirk, McCoy, and Savick beam to the station, regular one, and they find Terrell and Chekov alive, but they find kind of a gruesome scene, the second gruesome scene in this whole thing.
Yeah, no, it was a pretty jarring.
So, yeah, so Marcus's team has been slaughtered, and they find that the transporter has beamed something down to the middle of the planet somewhere, and that's where Kirk is like...
Right, let's go. Savick? Go.
Where are we going?
Where they went.
Suppose they went nowhere.
Then this will be your big chance to get away from it all.
That made me laugh out loud.
Yeah, it's fun, see? There's quippery in this movie. And it doesn't seem forced.
By the way, he didn't complain when he got beamed over to the space station the first time, even though he's supposedly terrified of the transporters.
Yeah, he's Mr. Cranky Pants, but still.
Yeah.
So they find Carol and David hiding inside the planetoid of Regula. And David seems to have a bitter feelings about Starfleet.
No, I said, oh, look, a sun revealed. It's a Kirk pity party, and then it's the worst fighting ever.
That's true. Well, I was worried that it was going to, you know, go back to another historic text and have David kill Kirk and have sex with Carol. And then he'd have to poke his eyes out. Khan has, by the way, been using Terrell and Chekov as spies. So he orders them to kill Kirk. And Terrell, in a valiant and heroic move, resists the eel.
Yeah, he pretty much just immolates himself.
Yeah, he kills himself rather than kill the Kirk. rather than kill Admiral Kirk. And Chekov, though, he just collapses and the eel leaves his body. But he collapses and it's the screaming of the eel is so great.
It's terrible, but yes.
But then Khan transport Genesis aboard the Reliant. So now Khan's got Genesis. But luckily, we get to see a little bit of what Genesis does.
Well, you get that whole interchange between Khan and Kirk. Still alive. Still old friend.
Oh, yeah.
The great. I said, oh, it's still terrible acting.
Oh, it is. They're both chewing scenery so much.
But then they get to go into the Genesis cave.
Well, before that, you're right. Before that, you get the most iconic part of this entire movie. Maybe the most iconic part of any movie in the 80s.
Khan, you've got Genesis.
But you don't have me. You are going to kill me, Khan. You're going to have to come down here. You're going to have to come down here.
I've done far worse than kill you. I've hurt you. And I wish to go on hurting you. I shall leave you as you left me. As you left her. Marooned for all eternity in the center of a dead planet. Buried alive. Buried alive.
Khan! Khan!
Yeah, through the planetoid.
Yes, it echoes throughout the heavens and Earth, or planetoid.
Apparently his voice reverberates through the ground.
Yeah, so, I mean, the fact that that is been used in innumerable parodies ever since.
Yeah, I use it all the time at home.
So, Khan believes that everybody is stranded on Regula One, but Kirk and Spock had this coded message. But yeah, I'm sorry, I interrupted you. They get to see a little bit about what Genesis Phase 2 was able to do.
Yeah, and so you go into the Genesis cave, right? And everybody's like, ooh, ah, oh, right? Everybody's all looking at the cave, and there's all this food, and there's a bounty, and there's all these plants. Where is the light coming from?
I don't know. That's a good question.
It's a cave. Well, where is the light coming from? It's a damn cave. So that's what I want to know. I understand they needed a cave to hollow out, but I'm like, so do they have some, you know, bioluminescence? It's one of those science things that bugs me. Like, there shouldn't be light. So, but that's just me.
They had a whole bunch of, like marijuana grow lamps on the ceiling of the cave. They didn't have the budget to show that, though.
Clearly. But then I wrote Bones flip-flops, because in the beginning of this, when he's first introduced to the Genesis device, he's all convinced it's some big Armageddon, end of the universe as we know it kind of device. But now he's flip-flopped to the tree-hugging granola, Birkenstock-wearing hippie, where it's like, he's amazed.
Well, and he was a little bit scene-chewing when he first he was going after Spock for the whole Genesis being a new Armageddon.
Yeah, me think he doth protest too much.
Exactly. So, it is impressive, though. And they have this cool little Kirk-Spock speaking in codes, which is pretty cheesy on rewatch, but the first time it's pretty cool.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It makes me laugh, but it also makes you think, yeah, well, you know, I wonder how much of that actually works in, you know, when people in the military don't know if they're being listened to.
Oh, I'm sure there must be a lot of that.
Yeah. Because now we would just look on Twitter, so.
Yeah, exactly. So they get sent back to the Enterprise, and they decide to go into the nearby Mutara Nebula.
I wrote down, I wonder how the Mutara Nebula feels about being violated like this.
So, because static discharges inside the nebula render shields useless and compromise targeting systems, Enterprise and Reliant are evenly matched. And here we have evenly matched ships with an uneven advantage to Kirk because Khan's inexperienced, because he has piloted a spaceship, certainly a Starfleet spaceship, zero times in the past.
Yeah.
And by the way, Joachim, or however he pronounces it.
I don't know. I would say it's Joachim, but I don't know.
Yeah, we can call him Valoof. So, yeah. Vince Valoof, his job is to tell Khan, dude, you got Genesis. You've crippled Kirk. Let's get out of here. We can go to whatever planet we want. We've won.
He's doing a really good first officer role, actually.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he's like, think, man. And Khan's like, no, he tasks me. He tasks you? Why can't he task you from the comfort of our own little planet again? I mean, you are the mighty Khan. We can go wherever we want. No, we're going to go after this guy. But they have this little space battle in the nebula where Khan is mortally wounded and half his face is burned off.
And some pretty gruesomely good effects.
Yeah. And he is going to activate Genesis, which is going to reorganize all matter in the nebula, including the Enterprise, because they don't have the warp drive to get out on time. But Spock goes to the engine room to restore the warp drive. McCoy tries to prevent Spock from entering in there because of the high levels of radiation. Are you out of your Vulcan mind? But Spock incapacitates the doctor with a Vulcan nerve pinch and performs a mind meld, telling him to remember. This is where we would insert a Guy Fawkes joke.
I also wrote down here, I'm like, okay, so it's a big radiation area. I get it. But why the hell wouldn't they have radiation suits, especially for a radiation area? And, you know, in the day and age where they have technology where they can beam people around, why wouldn't you be able to quickly beam somebody into a suit and then beam them into the place?
There you go.
Also, how would you be able to talk through a door that was radiation shielding? Because, I don't know, radiation seems to be able to escape. So if you can hear sound, you can get radiation. All these are just little details.
No, not necessarily. It's funny. The radiation is a funny thing, and I don't expect, God knows, of the three of us, The two of us are the least able to speak with any kind of authority on radiation, since the youngest of them has a brother Drew has a degree in nuclear engineering. But it seems like alpha particles and beta particles are stopped by different levels of stuff, if I remember correctly. Like a Carhartt jacket could stop an alpha particle. But anyway,
again, radiation suit.
Well, exactly, yeah. So, yeah, absolutely right. But Spock goes in, and he restores power. And the Enterprise escapes the explosion. Unfortunately, and the Genesis explodes and causes the gas in the nebula to reform into a new planet capable of sustaining life, right? It's a beautiful thing. They're all in awe. But then Kirk gets urgent communication from Bones saying, you better get down here. And so Kirk goes to the engine room, and Spock is dying of radiation poisoning. And,
oh, no, he's dead already.
Well, no, that's the thing. There's no saving him. He's going to die. But I like the little touch where Leonard Nimoy bumps into that clear wall.
Yeah.
Like, that actually sold it. Like, for me.
Yeah, if you weren't crying in the theater, that really started the tear factory.
Yeah, because, you know, he just wants to talk to his friend one last time. And they have meaningful words where they do a callback to the needs of the few, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, or the one.
Or the one.
And Spock talks about how he never took the Kobayashi Maru test until now. What do you think of my solution? And they're like, you know, I have always been and will always be your friend.
Yeah.
And Spock dies and Kirk's like, no. But he's not looking to the heavens like, con, like, no. He's more like, no. But then we have the burial scene.
So I'm of course raining on the parade again. I'm like, I said, well, I hope the Vulcan death customs you're to be put into a photon torpedo tube and jettisoned from the torpedo tube into space.
Well, they're doing it like a burial at sea.
Yeah, I also wrote down, like, would you really play Amazing Grace on the bagpipes for a Vulcan?
Oh, it has to do with the military funeral. That's what that's about. Because I wrote down, sure. I mean, my note said, goddamn bagpipes. See, they're totally correct. First of all, it's, you know, in Scotty's character to be dragging around the bagpipes anyway. But, you know, unfortunately, for instance, police funerals feature bagpipes. And there's nothing sadder than Amazing Grace on the bagpipes, as far as I'm concerned.
Ugh. Ugh. And then I wrote, Kirk cheated death. And then in parentheses I wrote, and acting school.
Indeed. And he and David have a nice little scene where,
with the most awkward hug ever.
Well, yeah. It's a father-son thing. It's pretty, it's very, very nice, actually. But it, you know, you have actually Kirk being like reflective.
I don't mean to intrude.
Oh, not long. I should be on the bridge.
Can I talk to you for a minute?
I poured myself a drink. Would you like it?
Lieutenant Savick was right. You never have faced death.
No, not like this. I haven't faced death. I've cheated death. I tricked my way out of death. And patted myself on the back for my ingenuity. I know nothing.
You knew enough to tell Savick that how he faced death is at least as important as how he faced life.
Just words.
But good words. That's where ideas begin. Maybe you should listen to them. I was wrong about you, and I'm sorry.
Is that what you came here to say?
Mainly. And also that I'm proud. Very proud to be your son.
Yeah, again, cheated death and acting school.
Yeah. So,
but then you get the end of the movie where you get to see the torpedo tube on the planet, and I wrote, "Oh, look, it's the monolith."
Oh, totally. It's totally the monolith.
The Sweeping Vista. Oh, this is 2001.
It is. Yep. But if you weren't already a little verklempt, if suddenly the theater or your living room wasn't a bit dustier and you got something in your eye, the movie ends with Nimoy giving the Star Trek Space the Final Frontier speech.
Oh, yeah. They pulled out every stop. They wanted you to have... This is like a three-hanky movie.
It was great. It's one of those things where at the end you feel drained from emotion and from, you know, I mean, you had the thrill of the space fights and everybody's happy, and then you have a little sadness and you have hope. I mean, you have everything, right? It's everything you want. It's Star Wars is what it is.
I don't think anybody tried to sleep with their sister in this movie.
No, but remember, once he killed Kirk, David was going after Carol.
Perhaps.
Yeah, so anyway. Yeah, so, sure, the first one was a very pretty movie, and this one was more action-oriented and way over-the-top acting from, like, the two leads, that's for sure. But still, a completely enjoyable movie.
No, I don't think Ricardo Montalban was over-the-top. I think he was just the right amount.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, yeah, neither of them were so over-the-top. I mean, it's what you expect. Because Kirk was over the top in the series. And that's what you wanted in this movie. You wanted the sense you got from the series. You have a little space family, and you have an overarching character thing, which actually takes on to the next movie. But in the middle, it's relationships. So you have Spock and Kirk, and you have Kirk and Scotty, and you've got Sulu indulging himself. Uhura still doesn't get much play. And Chekhov Chekhov had some good lines, but he certainly wasn't heroic.
No, he has a demotion coming.
Well, you know, it turns out, trivia-wise, Chekhov wasn't even on the show for the Space Seed episode where Khan was on. So of all the people that went down there, Chekhov was the least likely. Yeah, he wouldn't have remembered Khan.
Well, again, that's assuming you saw all of it anyway, but you didn't see every moment of the of.
Oh, let me tell you. An hour. I listened to some podcasts. Normally I wouldn't do this, but because I was getting ready and didn't have other podcasts to listen to because I was all caught up, I found some podcasts that were talking about this movie. And people were tripping all over themselves to try to excuse the Chekhov problem. They're like, well, maybe he worked in the galley at the time. He was below decks. You didn't really see him. He was promoted, you know. Because obviously he had to have been on the ship at some point, right? Because they didn't get any new crew members along the way, did they?
That's true.
Yeah. So he was making intergalactic meatloaf and just hadn't been promoted to bridge level work yet.
Or he was just off duty that day.
Yeah, it could have been. Yeah, he worked the B shift.
Yeah, I mean, who knows?
Or he worked
maybe in Central Bay.
He worked mid shift. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Maybe he tore his rotator cuff playing racquetball. Who knows? Well, we don't know. So, anyway, any other thoughts on Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan?
Originally, the title was going to be The Vengeance of Khan.
Yeah, I think. I mean, he was seeking revenge, but I don't know. It's hard to figure out how that would have changed things because the Wrath of Khan is so perfect.
Well, and then apparently they were worried that Star Wars, it was going to be Revenge of the Jedi, and they didn't want the Vengeance of Khan with Revenge of the Jedi.
That's
and
true.
So they were like, no, we want to make sure we differentiate ourselves. So it's going to be the Wrath of Khan. And then it ended up not being the Revenge of the Jedi, but instead the Empire Strikes Back.
Well, wasn't Revenge of the Jedi was The Empire Strikes Back? I thought Revenge of the Jedi was Return of the Jedi. Because they definitely...
It was, but The Empire Strikes Back was originally entitled Revenge of the Jedi.
Oh, okay. I did not know that.
Yeah.
Weird, wild stuff.
Was that your Johnny Carson impersonation?
And not an impersonation as much as...
That was your Dana Carvey. Dana Carvey.
It was
Johnny Carson.
Yeah, it was an homage. It wasn't a... No, Dana Carvey did a good Johnny Carson.
He did.
You know, as much as I don't like Kevin Spacey in person, reports of him in person He's probably a little tough to handle, kind of an arrogant ass, but okay. He is really good at impressions. Like if you've seen him on if you saw him, there's a clip online where they do the impression game on Jimmy Fallon, and he does a great Johnny Carson, and he does a great Bill Clinton.
Oh, I can see that.
Plus, he's a fantastic actor.
No, I really like Kevin Spacey as an actor. I there are a few things I've seen him in that I thought,
He's in some of my favorite movies of all time.
Oh, such as?
Well, he was in The Usual Suspects.
Oh, God, I knew that was going to be the first thing you brought up.
You didn't like that movie?
I hated that movie.
He was in The Ref?
I hated it. I hated it so much that listening to Kevin Pollak's book was excruciating in parts because he talks so much about the making of that movie.
Well, but what about The Ref?
Well, that's with Dennis O'Leary.
Yeah.
It was okay.
They wore candles on their heads. It's a fantastic movie.
My favorite Kevin Spacey movie is probably Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil,
which I have never seen.
Oh, it's on the list. It's a great movie.
Oh, well, we need to do the three-way with Travis.
Yeah. We got to do it with Travis because it's one. I think I made him watch it, and I think he fell in love with it as much as I already loved it. So.
And now, is that a nonfiction book?
Yeah, kind of. There is debate as to how much accuracy it actually has, but I will tell you that the movie stars the Lady Chablis, who is the drag queen, who was actually the Lady Chablis from the book.
Huh.
And there are actually a couple people who are characters in the movie who were actually true-to-life people from the book.
Have you listened to the book?
I have not listened to the book.
I'm curious whether it would be recommended.
I wonder, is it available?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, because
it definitely is.
I'm coming up on another book. I need a new book, so I'm almost done with the depressing book I'm finishing now.
Yeah, I've got the Kevin Pollak book on deck, and I'm listening to a book called Origin, which is a nice little book about Theodore Roosevelt was involved in it originally, but then it skips to the present time where these people think they have found Satan or a demon and it wakes up. And so it's kind of a science fiction horror kind of thing. Unfortunately, I'm trying to listen to it as I go to sleep. And so I've listened to the first 45 minutes of it like 6 times because I only get 20 minutes into it and fall asleep. And I have my iPod set to turn off after 45.
Adding this to my cart.
Yeah.
I'll listen to this next.
Anyway, anything else?
I'm almost.
Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on our new voicemail account to leave voice messages. Or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts. Dial it already.